Hello and welcome to Advanced Practice Weekly. My name is AJ Batt. Welcome to the program. Today I am joined by Timmy Austin, a consultant nurse, works in emergency care. Today he's here to talk to us about healthcare complexities. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi AJ, thank you for inviting me today.
So Tim, tell me a little bit about yourself and a bit of background. How long have you been working in the NHS for and what do you currently do?
So my background is registered nurse in the NHS for 33 years. Most of that time has been spent in urgent and emergency care. And my clinical background has mostly been in as an emergency practitioner or emergency nurse practitioner, working at enhanced and advanced level. I did my advanced practice MSc in 2003, and also did my independent prescribing, and I've been working in autonomous roles since then.
Wow, so you've been around quite a long time, Tim. You've obviously seen quite a few changes within the NHS and within the work streams that happen in the emergency care field, haven't you?
Definitely seen the sort of evolution of ED from quite early days when there was just one ED consultant, no specialist nurses, and gradually see the introduction of enhanced and advanced practice. And it's been quite exciting times, and we've still got a long way to go, so I'm enjoying being part of it.
Yeah, you've probably seen a lot more nurses and allied healthcare professionals now seeing patients at the bedside, which would have been traditionally seen by consultants and doctors, but are now being seen by our allied healthcare workforce, haven't you?
Definitely seen a expansion of all roles, and definitely this blended multi-professional workforce. I think we're still very much probably at the beginning of it. Certainly with advanced practice, it's very much multi-professional led. We have physios, nurses.
So Tim, just off the top of your head, do you know how many advanced practitioners you have working in your emergency department at the moment?
So in the emergency department, we have 5 ACPs, 3 qualified and 2 in training. But we do have aspirations to grow that workforce and grow the ACP workforce across the emergency floor. So in acute medicine, in SDEC, and in the wider specialities that do come to the emergency department. And although I won't be an integral part of that, I hope to help where I can.
That's really good to hear, especially coming from an HE point of view, where we want to commission more master's programs and more students on the ACP education ladder. So that's really nice to hear that we've got good grand designs on more advanced practitioners. So Tim, now we've got all the introductions out the way and a bit of background, should we have a look at what we're here to talk about today? Now, I spoke to you a few weeks back and you sent me some brilliant slides about healthcare complexities, and we're just going to talk through some of those healthcare complexities today. Now, and that you've got on this slide I've got in front of me, listeners, I'll have to describe it to you because this is the wonders of it being a radio podcast. There's no actual images. We've got 3 headlines here, and the first one is situational complexities, the next one is system complexities, and the third one is clinical complexities. So Tim, do you want to just talk through?
So I find healthcare complexity a really interesting subject, and it was partly born out of my experience of trying to expand my role. Certainly when I started out as an emergency practitioner, I was seeing people with sprained ankles, and it was quite a linear approach. You'd assess the patient, send them for x-ray. If they fitted the criteria, they either had a break or they didn't. But as I expanded, patients came with multiple comorbidities, polypharmacy, other social factors that affected how their recovery would be influenced. And I that's where I struggled, and I saw a lot of other people struggle to expand their practice.
So for me, the work from what I'm picking out of that, probably a lack of, would it be experience? Would it be training? Would it be being thrown in the deep end?
So certainly when I started to look deeper, it was all of those factors. It was that journey from novice to expert, that inexperience, the feeling, internal feeling of not having enough knowledge, and exposure to being in those situations, especially when we look at the multi-professional workforce. People come with different backgrounds. Certainly from my professional background of being a registered nurse, we do make autonomous decisions, but not we didn't really have a discharging role, which carries a fair bit of risk. Whereas I'm not a paramedic, but paramedics, from what I understand, have a lot more autonomy working at the roadside or in the patient's home. So all the professions had different barriers to overcome on this advanced practice journey. I suppose healthcare complexity has been described there's various definitions, and I suppose I'll just read this one. It's been characterized as multiple dimensions, including co-occurring or multifaceted medical conditions, age, frailty, socioeconomic realities, culture, environment, behavior, and systems factors. So even that's a mouthful, it's complex. It's also been described as a wicked problem in that there is not one solution. When I started, I would thought I needed to learn knowledge and that would sort the problem out. And I spent hours and hours reading books. And yes, it helped, but it still didn't solve the problem of how to manage that complex patient in front of me.
It's interesting because one of the things you said earlier on really rang true with me, that as a paramedic, we have the ability to discharge on scene, a little bit more autonomy. But when I came from working as in pre-hospital care and into the hospital environment, my major issue was managing the number of patients. Because on an ambulance, I would only ever see one patient at a time, or on a rare occasion, if we went to a big incident, there might be a few more. But there was always more paramedics around to help. When all of a sudden I was working in an urgent care centre and there was 100 people in the waiting room waiting to be seen, I found this probably one of the most stressful things I've ever had to deal with. So I can definitely relate to that. And it's really interesting, isn't it, how you see it from one side as a nurse and we see it from another side as a paramedic, depending on our background and training.
Brilliant. Yes. The other thing to mention is healthcare complexity has been described under three headings. And these headings are situational complexity, system complexity, and clinical complexity. And I'm going to spend a bit of time just talking through these briefly with a few examples.
So with the situational complexity, this is obviously multifaceted, isn't it? So I think that the major one is probably the environment for me. That's the one that stands out when I think about situational. What are the other situational complexities that I probably wouldn't think about that exist that are there?
Obviously, the environment is different in every ACPs, and that can be the work setting, communications. So other factors under the situational complexity, the major one for me is actually individual people factors. So that can be the individual, the dynamics within the team. Certainly as individuals, we come to work with our own worries, our own health issues. So we're complex human beings. And then we have to care for patients who are equally or more complex. So we are complex humans looking after other complex human beings. So it all adds to the mix of healthcare complexity.
That's really interesting because you picked up on something that I probably didn't come to my mind straight away. And that was me as a clinician is a complex person. I come to this role with lots of feelings, lots of thoughts, lots of processes already in my mind. But yet I probably wouldn't have put that into the situational complexity box. But I guess you have to reflect on yourself, don't you, and think about how you're going to act in this situation.
We come to work with our own worries, our own health issues, and then we have to do a whole day at work managing other people's similar issues, in most cases, much worse. So it definitely does have an effect on how our behaviour and our ability to do the job and learn.
Those human factors, aren't they? They really do come in and are quite important. Great. What else have we got on the situational complexity, Tim?
So activity factors. So this can be guidelines or policies. So this is work as prescribed. Task design or the equipment we use all has an influence. And then another one that's interesting is a term that I've described as dynamic uncertainty or complexity. And this is because the situation can change from minute to minute, hour to hour. So on looking at situational complexity, you can be working in the resus room and 1 minute you're one-to-one with a patient and the next minute two ambulances arrive with critically ill patients. And you then have to prioritize the care you give to patients. So it does have an effect. And on another level, patients can deteriorate. So on one minute you'll be going down one treatment sort of pathway or algorithm, and the next minute you have to reappraise the situation and consider other factors and maybe alter your treatment plan.
Yeah, and in the ambulance service we would call that a constant dynamic risk assessment to make it a bit more ambulance term. But yeah, absolutely, there's always stuff changing, especially in the emergency room, because you're getting squeezed from both sides, aren't you? You have patients coming in from the front door, you've got ambulances coming in from the back door, and you've just got patients pouring in constantly. It's that bucket of water constantly being filled. Listeners, we're going to put this slide within the download section of the podcast so you can have a look at it. And if you, when you do see it, you'll see how much is actually going on within that situational complexity. And there's a lot going on there. Brilliant, Tim. Shall we move on to the next one? Shall we pick up system complexity?
That's great. Yeah. So system complexity is probably something that we don't think of on a day-to-day basis, but does influence the way we practice. So the obvious one in most settings, but certainly in emergency care, is target-driven healthcare. So we have the four-hour standard. A lot of our day is spent around prioritising care to ensure that we get people admitted or discharged within that four-hour period. So that does influence the way we behave and the way we practice. Another one would be the structure of healthcare commissioning. Probably not something that we'd notice on a day-to-day basis, but new services are commissioned or decommissioned, has a direct influence on the type or the number of patients that attend your service. Another heading under the system complexity would be the CQC or Care Quality Commission. We probably don't realise it, but we all practice under the governing framework from the CQC, and it does influence the way we practice. Another heading under the system complexity would be the NHS plan. So a lot of the things we're talking about today, or that we are planning advanced clinical practice, will have been mapped out in the NHS plan. So some of our roles that we're doing are as a direct result of the NHS plan. And as we move up and we stretch out that leadership pillar within our roles and get more senior, we will become much more involved in planning and business planning for more advanced clinical practice posts and enhanced practice posts.
This area of system complexity for me is the one which I feel like I have the least amount of control over.
You're absolutely right there.
As a practitioner, there are lots of decisions being made at a much higher level. There is much more strategic stuff going on here. But ultimately, I wonder if those people that make these decisions understand how they affect the people on the ground actually doing the job. And you don't really realise it until it's been set out like this, do you? I've never really thought. Obviously, I know that if somebody produces a new pathway or does something within a trust that you have to adhere to, you just get on with it because it's a part of your role. But I don't think you actually probably comprehend how much goes on in the background and how much it affects you in your daily job.
That's a really interesting point, AJ. Certainly, the system complexity, when we're very clinically focused, certainly when we're in training and our early days of being a qualified ACP, we probably don't think too much about these, but it is part of the leadership pillar, and it is something to encourage us all to explore, because although we sometimes feel we don't have much influence, we can join special interest groups within the trusts, groups within HEE and NHS improvement, and get involved in your local ICS groups, so you can influence and almost extol the virtues of advanced clinical practice, because we do need people out there selling the role.
Yeah, I think, Tim, I think you're absolutely right. And it is, there's so much more going on out there. And being an experienced clinician with some leadership skills and even having a bit of background in research and having some evidence-based knowledge puts you in a really good place to help influence change, doesn't it? And I think more and more we're seeing that now, where ACPs are being invited to chair certain groups. We're developing these communities of practice, especially within the training hubs and the PCNs and all those kind of areas. I think we are having a bit more of an influence. It's definitely developing, I think, but you just, I hadn't really even realized this until I'd seen this slide and talked it through with you just now, that there's all this stuff going on and we are actually influencing change. So that's really interesting. So should we pick up the last one, Tim? Clinical complexities. This is probably the one that people most au fait with, have more knowledge about than anything else, I think. Definitely I did. Should we touch on a few headlines on there?
Thank you. Yes, you're absolutely right. I try to resist clinical complexity to the last because it's intuitively what we go for, and certainly I feel much more familiar talking about this subject. So clinical complexity is what we see every day in our patients. So patients come with comorbidities, polypharmacy, there's often multi-organ involvement. There is people who are in pain, which confounds sometimes our assessment processes. There are multiple diagnostics and imaging. And there were sometimes things like cascades of intervention and investigation. People end up on a pathway and it's quite hard to get people off pathways. And actually, as ACPs, we need to be thinking broadly so we don't go too much down rabbit holes. And finally, and one thing I want to talk a little bit more about is this is the linear reductionist paradigm. And by this, I mean that we sometimes are taught that things happen in a certain order. So a patient presents with X symptom, we do certain tests and we easily exclude some of the differentials and then we diagnose the patient, treat them and the patient's discharged. But what we do know in reality, the more complex patients we see is it's never linear. In fact, and especially as a junior, we can be confused by the complex patient or uncertainty where there is a high degree of uncertainty and multiple possible diagnoses. And we're easily confused by peripheral symptoms, but we don't know if they're important or not.
I can empathize with this situation. And it wasn't until I started working in the world of GP practices and learning from our general practitioners who are experts in complexity and managing comorbidities and medication. And it wasn't until I saw all of or had experience of working in that environment that I appreciated how to manage these complexities. And it still scares me now because there's so much going on with some patients, especially with things like renal failure and medication. Ugh, that's that for me is a big one. But when you see these expert GP practitioners that are amazing, then you can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
You're absolutely right, AJ. Certainly the consultant level practitioner or the GP or the experienced ACP has learned to navigate that journey through the patient's symptoms and various tests and decide what's important. And they don't seem too anxious about it either. When you start as a novice, you spend a lot of time worrying and sleepless nights worrying about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think you've become a master of risk management. I think that's really what's happening here. And I think you're right. You can't always send everybody home feeling completely again. You will send some patients home still in pain with that sciatic back pain because you haven't been able to cure it. You may have been able to help with the pain, but it might not ever go away. But that's something is out of your control, and that's very difficult. So yeah, I completely get that.
Certainly the linear reductionist paradigm is a fallacy, really, because as you progress through your journey, you do realize that actually sometimes we may not be able to provide a definitive diagnosis or a cure or a treatment. And that's quite dissatisfying when you first start out. I think part of that journey is realizing that we may not get there, but hopefully what we do in most cases is we progress the patient along that journey, even if it's to rule something out. And I think that is part of the journey of advanced clinical practice.
Yeah, definitely. I found that going through my journey, there's a whole lot of growth and you learn so much along the way. And there are so many things within this slide that I looked at and can think, oh, I've done that. I've felt this. I've been there. So, Tim, so these healthcare complexities encompass system, situational and clinical. What advice or help can you give the trainee advanced practitioner or even the qualified advanced practitioner out there to help navigate through these healthcare complexities?
I think the good news is there are some things we can do to help. We've already know it's a wicked problem. There is no one answer. And certainly when I first started, I thought the answer was knowledge because that's what I felt I need to learn the most. And to a certain extent, it is true. I first started as a trainee emergency practitioner many years ago. Every day on the tube, I was reading books and it certainly helped. But as I grew and expanded my practice, it wasn't just knowledge I needed. And really, I've summarized it up in that in many ways, what you need and what we do know in our practice is we need experiential learning. And to summarize, we need to swim in the sea of uncertainty. We need to experience supervised practice in the real world with experienced clinicians to get great feedback and see how, and absorb how they deal with these situations. And to a certain extent, it's time in that environment.
So I love this term, swimming in the sea of uncertainty. And you've got this great picture. I'm just going to describe it of this scuba diver under the sea and he's looking around him and he's got about seven sharks around him, all looking at him thinking he looks like a tasty morsel, which is exactly how it can feel, can't it? Sometimes when you're with that patient, you're a little bit out of your depth, you're swimming in the deep end, and that's exactly how it feels. And I think you're right. It is absolutely, as time goes on, experience allows you to be able to deal with these situations. And you've touched on a thing that's the massive buzzword at the moment, supervision of practice, which is the reason we're here today, which is to talk about how we can try and navigate these issues. And supervision is obviously a massive thing for the advanced practice community at the moment. So what type of supervision tips or activities can you give our listeners, do you think, that might help them get through their current situation?
So certainly on a day-to-day basis, we need supervisors, and this will vary from individual work environment. We need supervisors that understand the role development requirements of ACP, understand their base knowledge and their background. We need supervisors that are kind and approachable. Certainly in the early days of advanced practice, this was quite challenging when different professional groups mixed. There was definitely challenges because different professional groups had different ways of giving feedback. But certainly really to encourage sort of openness within those roles and good sort of feedback mechanisms that are supportive. And that will include training of the supervisors with potentially some specific requirements around supervising at ACPs and about the requirements.
So we're talking about supervisors knowing the curriculum, the trajectory of the trainees, so they can understand where that trainee is at that time, aren't we?
Absolutely. And it's building those relationships so that each of the supervisee understand each other, develop a way and a way of feeding back to each other that's non-confrontational, that's supportive and gives development plans that are realistic and smart.
I'm going to say that supervisor relationship is really important, isn't it? You have to feel like it's a safe space. You have to feel like you're able to reflect openly and honestly on the situation in hand, on your caseload, for want of a better word, for that patient you've just seen, and be really open and come to that table and say, look, I'm not sure I did this correctly, or I have done this really well. Can we discuss it or talk about it? Tim, what other types of activities would you include in your sort of non-linear learning or non-linear supervision activities? What other types of things do you think should be included?
So certainly within the supervisor relationship, there are lots of things that many people do already. So case-based discussions and case presentations are a really good way of doing it, often done outside the pressurized clinical environment where there is time for reflection and good feedback and support. There is also a thing that we probably do every day that we don't acknowledge, which is peer-to-peer support with our colleagues. And that involves around storytelling. How many times have you, your colleagues, or you told a story about a patient you saw the other day and about the learning, obviously within a confidential environment, but actually this hidden sort of learning that we do every day that we don't appreciate, but actually we do pick up things like that and we learn top tips. And storytelling as part of a mutual and peer-to-peer sort of support is really important. Another method that can be used is the significant event analysis exercise. This was originally piloted by NHS Scotland, and I think it was in primary care. It really looked at where a patient interaction had gone wrong or an event had occurred. It could be negative, but actually it can also be used for positive learning. And really, it's a much more holistic way of looking at the event, but looking at all those situational complexity things we talked about. So human factors that had an influence, environmental factors. So that's another broader way of looking at learning. Other methods include simulation training, which concentrates on team dynamics and the team approach. Quality improvement exercises. There's a big push now within learning for us all to learn quality improvement techniques. And that's, again, a chance for advanced clinical practitioners to influence from within to really change practice.
And I think from just going back a little bit there, you've mentioned the case-based discussion and case presentation, and then the quality improvement exercises. They both hit a couple of our advanced practice pillars, don't they, really nicely. So the case presentations, we can bring in a little bit of teaching and sharing our learning with junior members of staff or peers as well. And then the quality improvement gets you on that research trajectory, doesn't it? It starts you to look at data, gets you to start to think about how we can improve the services we deliver. And they're really good things to get done nice and early in that master's journey, aren't they? Because they're going to help you later on.
Some other things you can do, obviously, team building exercises within across teams, so multi-professional or within the ACP team itself. And other things that include conferences, workshops, informal visits to other units. I suppose it is also worth mentioning, along with swimming in the sea of uncertainty within your own clinical area, you can also go to other areas and of speciality. So in ED, you may want to gain some cardiology experience, so to spend some time with the cardiology ACPs or the consultants. And really getting it helps contribute towards building that broad base of knowledge and experience that you can apply later on down the line in clinical practice. There is one other thing that we can do as individuals that will indirectly help us on this journey to be advanced clinical practitioners. And it's going to sound a bit strange, but it really builds on human factors. And that is to wear a name badge with your first name on it, preferably in a really big font. So on a personal level, it really helps cut through that social red tape. It allows colleagues around you and people that are supervising you and giving you advice to just to use your first name. And it bestows a special meaning to you. So immediately you feel warmth to that individual, and feedback is much easier to give and receive. It also reduces hierarchy. It promotes safety because people feel they can come and talk to you without having to often the traditional name badge is your ID badge, and often half the time it's around the wrong way and the font's so small you can't read it.
I think you've hit on loads of really good reasons to do it. And there are very few bad reasons not to do it. So I think that's something we could probably all learn from. So that's really nice. So I'm just going to have a little recap, swimming in the sea of uncertainty and the things that we can do to try and help us through that. And there are peer-to-peer support groups where we can share opportunities, providing some case-based discussions. We can hit those case presentations and those quality improvements to help us hit those pillars of advanced practice. We can do some significant event analysis exercises, which often happen after really good or really bad experiences, but for both reasons, they should be done. Simulation training is always fun, team building exercises, and having that day off and going to a conference or a workshop, which is always lovely. So just to finish, Tim, we're going to just talk a little bit about cognitive bias. So do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, finally, I think cognitive bias, learning about cognitive bias and being aware of it's really important. And I know you will have probably studied this in other forums, but part of this non-linear learning is really just recognizing that we are fallible. Our brains do take shortcuts. And there are lots of cognitive biases that talked about, so anchor bias, getting caught up on one particular thing and not being able to think about what other things could be involved, or confirmation bias as tests come back and we've got an idea of a diagnosis and the more and more test results come back, they confirm that, but we get tunnel vision and we forget that actually there could be other causes. I think the overriding thing is to always assume you could be wrong.
Yeah, definitely. I remember from when I did my training, and I think one of the biases, I think it's triage bias, and it's if somebody's already put a diagnosis down on it, then you take that away with you when you pick up that patient out of the box. And you've got that in the back of your mind already, and it's never a good place to be. And you learn so quickly that's really not the right thing to do. Yeah, I think there are so many biases, aren't there, that the work around this area of human factors is huge now. There's so much out there you can read, but I think absolutely, Tim, having a knowledge that they exist and that you are vulnerable to them is really important. Brilliant. Right, Tim Yorston, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me, AJ. I really enjoyed it.
We've talked a lot about complexities in healthcare and non-linear learning, and it's been great having you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Join us next week for more advanced practice topics, and we'll see you soon. Take care, everybody. Thank you.